Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series with Issue 11, the U.S. and China. How much are we in each other's way? Donald Trump has made the idea that we are weak compared to China such a central part of his campaign that a video of his constant use of the word China has gone viral online.
People from China, they love me. Right. China. China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
The video goes on like that for 3 minutes. But it's not just that Trump is obsessed. One of President Obama's arguments for the 12-nation Asia-Pacific trade deal is that it does not include China, so the U.S. gets to set the terms of Asian trade more than China does. And after meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping last September, Obama warned Xi about the possibility of war because of Chinese actions over some islands in the South China Sea that China and Japan both claim.
I conveyed to President Xi our significant concerns over land reclamation, construction, and the militarization of disputed areas, which makes it harder for countries in the region to resolve disagreements peacefully.
President Obama last September. Let's listen to some history and how opposite the situation was during World War II when the U.S. was allied with China and President Franklin Roosevelt argued for coming to China's aid as a nation defending against aggression by Japan.
To the brave people who for nearly 5 years have withstood Japanese assault, destroyed hundreds of thousands of Japanese soldiers, and vast quantities of Japanese war munitions, it is essential that we help China in her magnificent defense and in her inevitable counteroffensive, for that is one important element in the ultimate defeat of Japan.
That was FDR in one of his fireside chats on the radio in 1942. The next year, the Chinese First Lady, Madam Chiang Kai-shek, came to Washington and addressed a joint session of Congress.
I can also assure you that China is eager and ready to cooperate with you and other peoples to lay a true and lasting foundation for a sane and progressive world society which would make it impossible for any arrogant or predatory neighbor to plunge future generations into another orgy of blood.
But after World War II, U.S.-China relations deteriorated. The Chinese communists, led by Mao Zedong, came to power over Chiang Kai-shek after a civil war in the late 1940s. The U.S. recognized the other side, the leadership of which fled to Taiwan and had no diplomatic relations with Beijing. In 1964, U.S. concern increased when China tested its first nuclear weapon. President Lyndon Johnson reacted.
Even if Communist China should eventually develop an effective nuclear capability, that capability would have no effect upon the readiness of the United States and our readiness to respond to requests from Asian nations for help in dealing with Communist Chinese aggression. The United States will also not be diverted from its efforts to help the nations of Asia to defend themselves and to advance the welfare of their people.
Johnson in 1964. Things got even worse right after that during the Vietnam War as China supported the North and the U.S. fought for the South. But that began to change in the early 70s as the Vietnam War began to wind down and the famous moment of Nixon going to China arrived.
The announcement I shall now read is being issued simultaneously in Peking and in the United States. Premier Chou Enlai and Dr. Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's assistant for national security affairs, held talks in Peking from July 9 to 11, 1971. Knowing of President Nixon's expressed desire to visit the People's Republic of China, Premier Chou Enlai, on behalf of the government of the People's Republic of China, has extended an invitation to President Nixon to visit China at an appropriate date before May 1972. President Nixon has accepted the invitation with pleasure.
That visit culminated in formal U.S.-China diplomatic relations being restored under President Carter in 1978, though the non-communist nationalists in Taiwan felt betrayed.
The government of the United States of America acknowledges the Chinese position that there is but one China, and Taiwan is part of China. Both believe that normalization of Sino-American relations is not only in the interest of the Chinese and American peoples, but also contributes to the cause of peace in Asia and in the world.
President Carter, in 78, throwing Taiwan overboard. President Reagan visited China in 1984 and spoke of peace and common humanity.
We may live at nearly opposite ends of the world. We may be distinctly different in language, customs, and political beliefs. But on many vital questions of our time, there is little difference between the American and Chinese people. Indeed, I believe if we were to ask citizens all over this world what they desire most for their children and for their children's children, their answer in English, Chinese, or any language would likely be the same. We want peace. We want freedom. We want a better life.
But the peace was shattered, and U.S.-China relations entered a fraught new period in 1989 because of the Tiananmen Square massacre, in which at least 300 pro-democracy protesters, maybe many more, were killed and thousands were arrested. President George H.W. Bush in June of 89.
During the past few days, elements of the Chinese army have been brutally suppressing popular and peaceful demonstrations in China. There's been widespread and continuing violence, many casualties, and many deaths. And we deplore the decision to use force, and I now call on the Chinese leadership publicly, as I have in private channels, to avoid violence and to return to their previous policy of restraint. The demonstrators in Tiananmen Square were advocating basic human rights, including the freedom of expression, freedom of the press, freedom of association. These are goals we support around the world.
Tiananmen Square intensified a debate in the United States over whether to keep trading with China, given its human rights record. Liberals tended to want to reduce trade and emphasize human rights. President Bush wanted to continue it. The debate continued for a decade over annual renewal of China's so-called most favored nation trade status. Like Bush before him, President Clinton kept renewing that trade status, and he went even further in his last year in office when he got Congress to grant China permanent trade status and entry into the World Trade Organization, the WTO.
It does deny its citizens fundamental rights of free speech and religious expression. It does define its interests in the world, and sometimes in ways that are dramatically at odds from our own. But the question is not whether we approve or disapprove of China's practices. The question is, what's the smartest thing to do to improve these practices? I believe the choice between economic rights and human rights, between economic security and national security, is a false one. You know, as we debate about China here, and we love to do it, it absorbs a great deal of our time and energy. It's easy to forget that the Chinese leaders and their people are also engaged in a debate about us there. And many of them believe that we honestly don't want their country to assume a respected place in the world. If China joins the WTO, but we turn our backs on them, it will confirm their fears.
President Clinton, in March 2000, ending one era of U.S. concern about China policy over human rights and really beginning another, concern over what China's economic policies in the free trade or WTO era are doing to American jobs. The debate came into full flower as a campaign issue in the 2012 Republican primaries.
My own view on the relationship with China is this, which is that China is stealing our intellectual property, our patents, our designs, our know-how, our brand names. They're hacking into our computers. stealing information from not only corporate computers, but from government computers, and they're manipulating their currency.
You slap on tariffs, you talk tough like that. Of course you have. That's got to be part of it as well. But in the end, we get a tariff in return if we don't sit down and have a logical, sensible conversation. And who's that hurt most? It hurts the small businesses and the small exporters who are trying to get back on their feet in this country at a time when this nation can least afford a trade war.
So we heard first Mitt Romney in 2012, and maybe you remember that one of the other Republican primary candidates that year was former Utah governor and former U.S. ambassador to China, John Huntsman, who thought Romney's attacks on China were cheap applause lines and not in America's interest. So we heard Romney and Huntsman in that clip. And that sounds awfully like the debate we're having in 2016, doesn't it? And that's our brief audio history of U.S.-China relations in the last 80 years or so. Joining us now to discuss some of it is Orville Schell, director of U.S.-China relations at the Asia Society here in New York. He has been dean of the journalism school at UC Berkeley, and he's written 10 books about China, including one to be released next month called Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 20th Century. Professor Schell, thanks for coming on for this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Pleasure.
How much would you say that we went from obsessing about China's human rights policies in the 90s to obsessing about its trade policies today?
Well, I do think it's fair to say that, you know, the U.S.-China relationship is a very manic one. And I think in your very nice little documentary, I mean, you captured that very well. We had periods where we've been very warm allies, where we've been very optimistic, very hopeful about the future, and then we go into these cycles where great divisions divide us and we are much less sanguine about our ability to work together. And I think, unhappily, we are on a potential precipice of something of a downturn now for reasons which have largely to do, I think, with China's very forward posture in the South China Sea, the East China Sea in relation to Japan, and its sort of general more truculent attitude as it seeks to exercise its wealth and power throughout the world at large.
So let me play, since you brought up the South China Sea and China's truculent attitude there, a little longer version of the clip that we played near the beginning of President Obama warning China about flexing its military muscles there. This is just after President Obama and President Xi Jinping of China met last September.
We did have candid discussions on the East and South China Seas, and I reiterated the right of all countries to freedom of navigation and overflight and to unimpeded commerce. As such, I indicated that the United States will continue to sail, fly, and operate anywhere that international law allows. I conveyed to President Xi our significant concerns over land reclamation, construction, and the militarization of disputed areas, which makes it harder for countries in the region to resolve disagreements peacefully.
President Obama last September. Well, Michelle, this hardly comes up in the presidential debate. The issue page on Trump's website, for example, is just called Trade with China. It's not called Relations with China. And all the details of his proposals, such as they are, they're more declamations than proposals, but they all have to do with trade. And the average American knows something about U.S. trade with China, even if it's a misimpression, but knows very little about what China's doing militarily over there. And yet to listen to that clip of President Obama, he sounds so serious and worried and like war could break out that could even embroil the United States. How much of a threat is it?
Well, I think, you know, first thing that should be said is that Trump's sort of overall vision of global foreign policy is has many unpixelated, you know, blank places in it. It is far from comprehensive, and those places where he has made utterances are far from thoughtful. I think trade is an issue, and I think it's quite striking that we've gone from a period where we were sort of embracing globalization, and trade was the sort of prime mover in this process of bringing countries together in a more global context, to a position where people are very, in America at least, and elsewhere in the world, are very circumspect about this whole process in terms of their own interests.
In both parties, by the way.
In both parties, and I should say in Europe, too. So this isn't exclusive to America. But I think on top of this, the issues which we've dealt with in the past, which certainly include trade and the differences in our political systems and values and human rights, we now do have this other very sort of geostrategic question about China's pretensions to basically sort of expanding its footprint throughout the whole sort of maritime Asian region. And it is this that President Obama was talking about, the infamous nine-dash line, which stretches down from the South China coast all the way past the Philippines, Brunei, right down to Indonesia, sweeping up around Singapore, Malaysia, and Vietnam, has changed what was 5 or 6 years ago a rather extraordinary Chinese accomplishment. Namely, it had engendered very friendly relationships with most Southeast Asian countries, and now it has turned it into one that is very fraught with tension and growing animosity.
Why? What do they want? Why are they doing this?
This is exactly the question that one must ask. What's to be gained? When Deng Xiaoping came to America in 79 to restore diplomatic relations with Jimmy Carter, he stopped in Japan and said of these island disputes, we can't solve them now. Let's kick them down the road for smarter generations in the future to solve. Very smart decision. Now, under Hu Jintao and Xi Jinping, they've suddenly arisen, and China is very aggressively staking its claims. I think that the answer to your question is that now that China is stronger and more powerful and wealthier, it believes that it has sort of the manifest destiny to become the sort of the keystone of the arch of Asia. And I think having written this narrative that the party has written over the past 100 years of oppression by imperialist powers, exploitation, being bullied, being a victim, it now wants to put the shoe on the other foot. It wants to be the one who controls the levers of power in Asia. It wants to be sort of the leader of Asia and win the fealty of all the other countries, lesser countries to be sure, smaller that are around it. The only problem is, of course, that Japan is not so small. It has a very powerful military, economically very substantial.
And we have a mutual defense treaty with Japan. I was on a tour for journalists of China in 2012, and because of some of the talk about the Chinese military and these conflicts with Japan over these islands, this was a big topic of conversation among us after we, you know, heard people talk about this, that, oh, we have a mutual defense treaty with Japan, which means if they're attacked, we're obliged to send in the U.S. military to defend them. So what do you think the implications of that are, or is that not worth talking about so much because really we wouldn't go there?
Well, I think it is worth talking about it. We also have a treaty obligations to the Philippines, a much weaker power, where the Chinese have been even more aggressive in terms of building islands, putting more than landing strips, strips that can take fighter bombers and having all sorts of other kinds of militarization on these islands. So this is something very new, and you might wonder why shouldn't China be able to have its Monroe Doctrine, just as we sort of claim the Caribbean. Why shouldn't China be able to claim all of its adjacent waters? Well, they may try, but the problem is, of course, that Japan is a major power, and there are no major powers in the Caribbean. So there's immediately a standoff there and a lot of bad blood between these two countries, and getting much worse. So this is not a situation where it's easy just to write the whole area off as a Chinese sphere of influence, because there are other powers. Korea, too, have legitimate claims, and they have treaty obligations with the U.S.
Getting back to trade, as an expert on Chinese wealth and power, as the title of your forthcoming book says, how much would you say that the things Romney listed in the clip of him that we played from 2012 and that Trump emphasizes today, and frankly that Bernie Sanders talks about too, that China steals intellectual property, hacks our computers, and manipulates their currency, and so does Clinton, to be fair, she brings all these things up, that China, either uniquely among nations or with unique implications because of their size and impact, is that much of a miscreant in let's say, intelligence and trade affairs?
Well, I think China has been doing all of these things. The common wisdom has been in Washington and amongst people who want to see China change is that if the U.S. will only engage it, will include it in WTO and other multinational frameworks, that it will slowly come around, that open markets will ultimately equal open societies, and things are trending in the right direction. And I think there was a certain credibility to that argument in the past. I think what makes the present so uncertain is that it really, people are beginning to doubt, and when I say people, you know, China specialists, diplomats, whether in fact China under Xi Jinping is headed in the direction of more openness, more constitutional government, rule of law, all of these things which we thought that inclusion would help advance. Now, if in fact they aren't sort of headed in that general historical teleological direction, that raises some very serious policy questions for the U.S. It means that maybe giving them the most favored nation treatment, including them in the WTO, including them in, you know, various other global protocols, has not had the effect that we thought it would and would beg some reconsideration.
So we've passed from the Tiananmen Square era into an era of complacency about human rights in China, I think it's fair to say, and maybe around the world with our focus on terrorism and jobs.
Well, I mean, human rights did, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said when she came into office, she said she didn't think it ought to trump our ability to handle other vital questions between us, such as climate change and trade, and there are others. And I think that was a generally fairly sage move. But I think it's in the years that have intervened, sort of that trade-off has not delivered in the way that we hoped that it would. Instead, China's become considerably more obdurate. And in a certain sense, you can understand that as they've grown stronger and wealthier. But on the other hand, it has not engendered a feeling of peace and relaxation, particularly in Asia. And we now find ourselves in the strange position where, as once the U.S. was being thrown out of the Philippines and there was a very much more cooler attitude towards the Seventh Fleet and U.S. presence in the Pacific. Now, countries like Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia are all much better disposed towards the U.S. and inviting U.S. military protection back in.
Before you go, in the coming days in this series on U.S.-China relations, as issue 11 in our 30 issues election series, we'll look more deeply at trade and how much U.S. manufacturers are moving American jobs to China and have been over the last several decades, and what should be done about it by the next president, whoever he or she is. But what's your own view? Are you an open markets person? Do you think, you know, you seemed to say something earlier that indicated the U.S. is walking away from globalization when maybe it shouldn't be, but maybe we should be.
I think the U.S. has, generally speaking, profited greatly from being an open economy with open markets, both in terms of foreign direct investment coming into our country and our trade being able to go out. I think there have been some abuses, and in this sense, there has been a playing field that needs to be leveled with China. How we do that and whether we can do that, that is the challenge of the next president. But I do think that, generally speaking, these trade agreements have benefited us. And I think it's worth noting now that, manufacturing has started to come back to the United States because of robotics, because it's actually cheaper to do it here and have it closer to the market. So there is a kind of a cyclical motion that we really have to sort of pay attention to before we get too worried about China running away with all the goods.
Orville Schell, Director of U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society here in New York, and author of 10 books about China, including one to be released next month called Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 20th Century. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
And we will continue this with a closer look at the candidates' positions and what's right and wrong about them and about our jobs relationship with China these days, coming up tomorrow in part two of issue 11 of our 30 Issues election series. And you can sign up for our 30 Issues newsletter for free. We send out an email once a week with thoughts from me about these segments that we're doing and some other things. You can sign up for free at wnyc.org/30issues. Use the digits 30, that's wnyc.org/30issues, to sign up for our free 30 Issues newsletter.